This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Knights of Dark Renown, written by David Gemmell and read by Ben Onwukwe. Knights of Dark Renown.
Who calls for Olifair?
Ruwed asked. The man dismounted.
One who knows him well, said the rider, approaching the armorer.
All color fled from Ruat's face as he recognized the workmanship of the battered helm and the gray eyes of the once knight.
Manannan, he whispered. It cannot be.
It is Manannan, said the once knight.
It is the traitor, Manannan.
I have no right to ask this of you, but it would be pleasant if you would remove this damned helm. I fear the beard within the neck plates is strangling me to death. I have worn it for 6 years.
How did you get back?
I never went.
As Sameldanach beckoned us forward, something inside me snapped. Fear swept through me like a storm, and I turned my horse away into the shadows.
Despair struck Ruad anew.
Then you do not know what became of them.
No. Will you help me?
I cannot, Manannan. If I could, I would do it in an instant. But the spell I cast was to protect you in the inferno beyond the gate, and the gate is the key. All spell locks were made to be undone the moment you passed back through the gate.
What are you saying? That I'm doomed to die in this metal cage?
No, said Ruad softly.
I'm saying you must pass the gate and return.
The once knight staggered as if struck.
Pass the... alone? When I could not do it surrounded by the finest warriors in the world? Impossible!
You would at least know the fate of your friends. You might even find them and bring them home. The gods know how they are needed now.
Prologue. He was 9 years old, torn between grief and joy, and he was flying beneath the stars and above a land bathed in moonlight. It was a dream. Even at 9 years old, he knew that people did not really fly. But still, at this moment, dream or no, he was alone and free. No one to chastise him for stealing a honey cake. No one to beat him for failing to see a finger mark on the silver as he polished and polished, hour upon hour. Somewhere, though he knew not where, his mother lay cold in death, and the grief was like hot knives in his soul. But as children will, he forced it from his mind and looked to the bright diamond stars. They seemed so close, and he tried to soar towards them. But ever they remained, glittering and cold, far from his reach. He slowed in his flight and gazed down. The land of the Gabala was so small now, and the world so large. The forests of the ocean lay beneath him like a wolf pelt, the mountains merely wrinkles in an old man's skin. He dropped lower, falling, spinning towards the ground, and screamed in his fear as the mountains roared up towards him, jagged and threatening. His dizzy fall slowed and he floated once more. On the sea beyond Persia port, he could see the great triremes with their square sails, their oars lifted, and on the land the lights of the towns and cities. 4 huge braziers were lit on the walls of Machtha fortress, twinkling like candles on a cake. He sped away from the lights towards the distant mountains. He wished he might never go home, wished he could float like this forever, safe from the many tortures of slavery. While his mother had been alive, there had been someone who cared for him. Not as a slave boy, but as Lug, the child, flesh of her flesh. Her arms had always been open to him. Grief and pain swamped him once more. When she had become ill, Lug had been told she needed rest, but it did not help. They had sent for the healer, Gwydion, but he was away in the city of Firbolg, Lug had watched the flesh vanish from his mother's features, seen her change from a living, loving woman to a skeletal creature, whose eyes could look at him without recognition, and whose arms did not have the strength to open for him. And then she was gone, while he slept. He had kissed her good night and been led away to a room he now shared with five other boys. In the morning he had finished his chores and run to her chamber, only to find her covered with a white linen sheet. This he had pulled back from her face. The eyes were closed, the mouth open, and no trace of breath or movement could be seen. The elderly house slave Patricius had found him there, and carried him back to his own room. Lug had been aware of the old man, but he could not move. He was frozen in shock. He felt himself tucked up into Petrosaeus's bed, the warm blankets around his shoulders. But he could not even close his eyes. The old man had stroked his face and gently closed his lids. For a long while, Lug had slept. Then something inside him snapped, and his spirit had sailed free into the night air. He shivered, though he felt no cold, and wished he could bring his mother back. Just then his eye was caught by movement far below. A line of riders, 9 of them, were riding out into the night on tall white horses. Lug dropped towards them and saw that they were knights, dressed in silver armor, white cloaks draped to their saddles. They formed into a line in a meadow, and white mist billowed around the horses' hooves like a ghostly sea. On a nearby hillside, Lug saw a man, his face partly hidden by a dark hood, on a velvet cloak. The man was chanting, but the language was unknown to the boy. The knights sat silently as the mist deepened. Lug came closer, avoiding the chanting man and settling himself on another hillside near some trees. As he came to the ground, he sank through it. A touch of panic spurred him and he rose again, wishing that he was solid. The wish became reality and he sat down upon the grass. The mist had not reached the upper slopes of the hill and he settled down to watch the knights. Their armor glistened in the moonlight, round helms under tall black plumes, silver neckplates linked to curving shoulder guards, engraved breastplates, thigh guards and greaves. Yet they carried no shields. 9 riders on 9 white stallions. Lug remembered the stories Patricius told in the slaves' hall at the solstice feast, and he knew then upon whom he spied. The legendary knights of the Gabala. Lug did not know their names, save that the Lord Knight was Samildanach, the greatest swordsman in the realm. The boy scanned the group. There at the center, taller than the others, shining silver raven wings adorning his helmet, was Samildanach, sitting silently, waiting. But for what? Lug transferred his gaze to the chanting man, and suddenly the horses began to whinny in fear. The knights held them steady, and Lug's mouth dropped open, for the stars were disappearing from the sky, as a great black gateway formed before the riders. A sliver of silver grey appeared in the rectangle of black, and a bitter wind howled through the opening. Then the mist rose like a huge wave to engulf the knights, and unearthly screams sounded from beyond the black gate. "Follow the sword!" came the cry. And Lug saw the blade of Samildanach shining like a lantern, and heard the drumming of hooves as the knights thundered forward. Then there was silence, and the darkness faded, leaving the stars to shine once more. Lug looked across at the far hillside, but the chanting man had gone. The mist gathered and flowed up the hillside, and Lug rose and tried to fly, but he could not. His body was solid and rooted to the earth. The cold wind touched him, and he shivered. The dream was no longer comforting, and he was desperate to return home. But where was home? How far had he flown? A noise came to him through the mist, a slithering, rustling sound. He spun and tried to scan the ground, but the grey fog was everywhere. Lug ran back up the hill, heart pounding, but he slipped and fell in the muddy grass and rolled to his back. A black shadow reared over him, and sharp talons raked down at his body. He rolled again desperately as they scored the skin of his chest.
No!
he screamed, as the slavering jaws of the beast dropped towards his face. He threw up his arm. A blazing beam of golden light sprang from his fingers to engulf the creature, and with a scream of agony it disappeared as Lug sank back to the grass. Another shadow fell across him, and he cowered to the ground.
"Do not be afraid," said a voice.
Lug looked up to see the outline of a man. The moon was shining over the stranger's shoulder, and his face was in silhouette, his features impossible to see.
"I'm frightened," said Lug. "I want to go home."
"And so you shall, my boy. And then this dream will be forgotten."
"What was the beast?"
"It came from beyond the gate. But it is dead. You destroyed it, boy, as I knew you would, for within you is the power. Farewell. We will meet again."
"Who are you?"
"I am the Dagda. Sleep now, and return home."
Lug had closed his eyes and slipped from awareness. When he opened them again, he was lying in Petraeus's bed. The old man was sitting beside him, dozing in a chair. Lug rolled over, the bed creaked, and the old man awoke.
"How are you feeling, Lug?" "What am I doing here, sir? Where is my mother?"
"She is dead, boy," said Patricius sadly. "We buried her this afternoon."
The blanket slid from the boy's chest as he sat up.
"Dear gods,"
whispered Patricius.
"What have you done?"
Lug looked down. His chest was scored in four shallow cuts, which had bled profusely, drenching the sheet below the blanket. When Patricius pulled the bedding aside, the boy's legs were covered in dried mud.
"Explain this, Lug. Where did you go while I was sleeping?" "I don't know," said Lug. "I don't know anything. I want my mother. Please."
The old man sat beside the weeping boy and placed his arms around him.
"I'm sorry, Lug. Truly."
Chapter 1. The rider paused at the crest of the pass, the wind swirling about him and screeching through the mountaintops. Far below him, the lands of the Gabala stretched green and verdant, ribbon streams and shimmering rivers, hills and vales, forests and woods. All as he remembered, echoing his dreams, calling for his return.
"Home, Kuan,"
he whispered, but his words were whipped away by the wind and the tall grey stallion did not hear him. Touching his heels to the horse's side, the rider leaned back in the saddle as his mount began the long descent. The wind dropped as they neared the deserted border fort, its gates of oak and bronze hanging on broken hinges. The Gabala eagle had been hacked from them, only the edge of a wingtip left on the rotting wood, and this covered by a brown and green patina that all but merged it with the timber. The rider dismounted here. He was a tall man wearing a long hooded cloak, a heavy scarf wound about his face, and holding the hood in place. He led the stallion into the derelict fort, and halted before the statue of Mananan. The left arm was broken, and lying on the cobbles. Someone had taken an axe or hammer to the face, and the chin was smashed, the nose split.
"How soon they forget," said the newcomer.
Hearing his voice, the stallion moved forward, nuzzling at his back. He turned, removed his thick woolen gloves, and stroked the beast's neck. It was warmer here, and he unwound the scarf, draping it over the pommel of his saddle. As he pushed back the hood, sunlight flashed from the silver helm he wore.
Let us find you a drink, Kuan, he said, moving to the walled well at the center of the courtyard. The bucket was warped by the sun, gaping cracks showing beneath the iron rings. The rope was tinder dry, but still usable if handled with care. He searched the deserted outbuildings and returned with a clay jug and a deep plate, then stood the jug in the bucket before lowering both into the well. When he carefully drew the bucket up, water was gushing from the cracks, but the jug was full, and he lifted it clear and drank deeply, placing the plate on the cobbles he filled it. The stallion dropped its head and drank. The rider loosened the saddle girth and poured more water into the plate, then climbed the rampart steps and sat in the sunshine. This was the end of empire. He knew. Not the blood-drenched battlegrounds, the screaming hordes, the discordant clash of steel on steel. Just the dust blowing across the cobbles, limbless statues, warped buckets in the silence of the grave.
You would have hated this, Samuel Danach, he said. This would have broken your heart.
He searched inside himself for any grief over the fall of the Gabala, but there was no room. All his grief was for himself as he gazed down at his statue.
Mananan, Knight of the Gabala,
one of the nine, greater than princes, more than men. He delved into his hip pouch, pulling clear a silvered mirror which he held up before his face. The once knight looked into his own deep blue eyes, then at the square face and the silver steel which surrounded it. The plume was gone from the helm, hacked away in some skirmish to the north. The visor raised now, dented by an axe blade in the Fomorian War. The runic number that named him had been torn from the brow in a battle to the east. He could not remember the blow. It was one of so many he had endured during the 6 lonely years since the gate closed. His gaze shifted to the blade rings that circled his throat, and pictured the beard growing beneath them, slowly, oh so slowly, preparing to choke him to death. What a death for a Gabala knight, imprisoned within his helm, strangled by his own beard. Such was the price of betrayal, Mananan told himself. Such was the penalty for cowardice.
Cowardice. He rolled the word in his mind.
During the last lonely, aimless years of wandering, he had proved his physical courage time and time again in sword play, in the charge, in the long wait before the onslaught. But it was not his body which had let him down on that dark night 6 years before, when the black gate yawned and the stars died. It was altogether a different cowardice which had robbed him of the power to move. Not so the others. But then Samuel Danach would have braved the fires of hell with a handful of snow, as with the others, Peteus, Edrin, all of them.
Damn you, Olafair, hissed the once knight. Damn your arrogance.
Mananan returned his mirror to its pouch. He rested for another hour and then stepped into the saddle. The citadel was 3 days' ride west. He avoided towns and settlements, buying his food at isolated farms and sleeping in meadows. On the morning of the 4th day he approached the citadel. Mananan steered his stallion through the trees and into what had once been the rose garden. It was overgrown now, but here and there a bloom still flourished, stretching above the choking weeds. The paved path was mostly covered by grass and small blue flowers. It was only natural, thought the once knight, 6 years of wind-blown soil settling over the carefully laid stones. The side gate was open, and he rode into the courtyard. Here and there grass seeds had settled in the cracks of the pavement, fed by the fountain pool which overflowed its marble parapet. He dismounted, his silver armor creaking and his movements slow. The stallion stood motionless.
Not as you remember it, Kuan,
whispered the knight, removing his gauntlet and stroking the beast's neck. They have all gone.
He led the horse to the pool and waited as it drank. A wooden shutter nearby was caught by the wind, which cracked it against the window frame. The horse's head came up, ears laid flat against its skull.
"It's all right, boy," Mananan soothed. "There is no danger here."
As the stallion drank, he loosened the saddle girth and lifted the pack from its back. Hoisting this to his shoulder, he walked up the steps to the double doors and entered the welcome hall. Dust had gathered here, and the long carpet smelt of mildew and corruption. The statues stood staring at him with sightless eyes. He felt the burden of his guilt grow even stronger, and pushed on past the figures to the chapel at the rear of the building. The hinges groaned as he forced open the leaf-shaped door. No dust disturbed this place, with its low altar, but the golden candlesticks were gone, as were the silver chalice and the silken hangings. Yet still the chapel emanated peace. He lowered his pack and unfastened the leather-binding thongs. Then he moved to the altar, removed his baldric and scabbard, and unbuckled his breastplate, slipping it under the protruding shoulder plates. Carefully he placed the armor on the altar. Shoulder plates and habergeon followed. He would miss the sleeveless coat of mail. It had saved his life more than once. Hip shields, thigh guards, and greaves he laid upon the stone, placing his black and silver gauntlets atop the breastplate.
"Let it be over," he said,
reaching up to release the helm, but his fingers froze as fear flowed in him. The spell had been cast by Olafair in this room 6 years before. But without the wizard, was the peace of the chapel enough to remove it? Mananan calmed himself. His finger touched the spring lock, but the bar did not move. He pressed harder, then dropped his hand. Fear fled from the onset of his anger.
"What more do you want of me?"
he screamed. Sinking to his knees, he prayed for deliverance. But although his thoughts streamed out, there was no sense of their reaching a destination. Exhausted, he rose, a knight without armor. Moving to his pack, he dressed swiftly in well-fitting woolen trews and leather tunic, then looped his baldric over his shoulder with the sword and scabbard nestling at his right side. Finally, he pulled on a pair of soft doe-skin riding boots and gathered his blanket. The pack he left where it lay. Outside, the stallion was cropping grass at the far wall. The man who had been a knight walked past the beast and onto the smithy. It too was dust-covered, the tools rusted and useless, the great bellows torn and tattered, the forge open, a nesting place for rats. Mananan picked up a rusted saw blade. Even had it been gleaming and new, it would have been useless to him. The silver steel of the helm was strong enough in its own right, but with the added power of Olafair's enchantment, it was impervious to everything but heat. He had once endured 2 hours of agony as a smith sought to burn the bar loose. At last, defeated, the craftsman had knelt before him.
"I could do it, sir, but there would be no point. The heat needed would turn your flesh to liquid, your brain to steam. You need a sorcerer, not a smith."
And he had found sorcerers and would-be wizards, seers and witcher women. But none could counter the spell of the armorer.
"I need you, Olafair," said the once knight. "I need your wizardry and your skills. But where did you go?"
Olafair had been above all a patriot. He would not have left the realm unless forced. And who could force the armorer of the Gabala knights? Mananan sat silently among the rusted remains of Olafair's equipment and fought to remember conversations of long ago. Considering the size of the empire it had once ruled, the lands of the Gabala were not large. From the borders of Fomoria in the south to the coastal routes of the Cithaeron was a journey of less than 1,000 miles. east to west, from the Nomad Steppes to the Western Sea and Asrapur, was a mere 400. One fact was sure. Olifair would avoid cities. He had always hated the marble monstrosity of Firbolg. Where, then, and under what guise? Olifair had been merely the name chosen by the armourer. But there was another name he used when wishing to travel alone and unreported. Mananan had discovered this by chance 10 years before, during a visit to the northernmost of the 9 duchies. He had stopped at a weighhouse and seen the owner showing off a small bird of shining bronze that sang in 4 languages. As the man lifted his hand, the bird circled the room and a sweet perfume filled the air. Mananan had approached the man, who had bowed low upon seeing the Gabala armor. "Where did you come by the bird?" he had asked.
"It was not stolen, sir, I promise you, on the lives of my children."
"I am not here to judge you, man. It was merely a question."
"It was a traveller, sir. 2 days ago. A stocky man, ugly as sin. He had no money for a room, and paid with this. Am I right to keep it?"
"Keep it, sell it. It is not my concern. Where did this traveller go?"
"South, sir, along the Royal Road."
"Did he give you a name?"
"Yes, sir, as is the law, and he signed the register. I have it here."
He lifted the leather-bound book and showed it to the knight. Mananan caught up with Olifair the following afternoon on a long, open stretch of road. The armourer was riding a fat pony.
"Is there no peace?" Olifair asked. "What is the problem?"
"There is no problem that I know of," Mananan told him. "This is a chance meeting. I saw your handiwork at the inn. A little extravagant for a night's lodging, was it not?"
"It's flawed. It would not last out the week. Now ride on and leave me to a little serenity. I will see you at the citadel in a week."
Now, as Mananan looked about him at the cobwebs and the decay, he shivered. Perhaps Olifair would have chosen another name. Perhaps he was dead. But with no other clues, the once knight had no choice. He would ride to the north and seek news of a craftsman called Ruad Rofessa. The boy gripped the tweezers, lifted the tiny bronze sliver, and took a deep breath. He licked his lips as he leaned over the bench, his hand shaking.
"Easy now," said the ugly man sitting beside him. "Be calm and breathe easily. You are too tense."
The boy nodded and rolled his shoulders, seeking to ease the knots of tension. His hand steadied and the bronze sliver slid into place at the back of the model.
"There,"
said the man triumphantly, his one good eye examining the metal hawk.
"Now take the wing and lift it. Carefully, now."
The boy did so, and the wings spread effortlessly, the bronze feathers gleaming.
"And release."
The wings snapped back into place against the scaled body.
"I did it, Ruad! I made it!"
cried the boy, clapping his hands.
"Indeed you did,"
the man agreed, a wide grin showing his crooked teeth.
"In only a year you have duplicated that which took me 3, when I was your age. But then you had a better teacher than I."
"Will it fly?"
asked the boy. Ruad Rofessa ruffled the lad's tightly curled blonde hair. He shrugged his huge shoulders and stood stretching his back.
"That will depend on your ability to draw the air magic. Come, we will sit for a while."
Ruad moved away from the bench and through the workshop to a wide room where 2 deep chairs were set before a hearth in which a log fire blazed. There he settled himself, stretching his short legs towards the blaze and resting his massive arms across his chest. The firelight gleamed on the bronze patch covering his left eye and highlighted the silver streaks in his thinning black hair. The boy joined him. He was tall for his age, and had almost outgrown the tunic of his house.
"You did well, Lug," said Ruad. "One day you will be a master craftsman. I'm greatly pleased with you."
Lug blushed and looked away. Compliments were rare from Ruad, and never before had he been asked to sit by the fire.
"Will she fly?"
"Can you feel the magic in the air?" countered Ruad.
"No."
"Close your eyes and rest your head back against the chair."
Ruad lifted a heavy poker and stirred the blaze to life, adding 3 fresh logs to the fire.
"The currents of magic are many. The colors are deep and sometimes startling. You must begin with the colors. Think of white, which is peace, harmony. Picture the color, flow with it. Can you see it?"
"Yes,"
whispered Lug.
"When there is anger, or hatred, or pain, other than that of the flesh, white is the answer. Summon it. Blue is the sky, the power of the air, the dream of things which fly. Blue is what calls them on halting wings. Can you see the blue?"
"I can, master."
"Then call on the blue."
Ruad closed his good eye and aided the boy in his search.
"Do you have it, Lug?"
"I do, master."
"And how do you feel?"
"I can sense the sky calling me. I feel the need for wings."
Ruad smiled.
"Then let us return to the hawk. Hold to your feeling."
The 2 craftsmen made their way to the workshop, where the boy lifted a tiny knife.
"Am I ready?"
he asked.
"We shall see," answered Ruad. "Release the magic of the blue."
Lug nicked the skin at the base of his right palm and held his hand over the bird's metallic head. A single drop of blood splashed on the beak.
"Now the wings," Ruad ordered. "Swiftly now."
Lug followed the instructions, then stepped back.
"Press your finger over the cut and stop the bleeding."
Lug did so, but his blue eyes were fixed on the bird. At first there was no movement, but then the golden head jerked, the plate rings grinding together. Slowly the wings spread and the hawk rose from the bench, soaring through the open window in search of the sky. The man and the boy ran out onto the mountainside to see the golden bird fly higher and higher. Suddenly it faltered, and Lug watched as a bronze feather floated away from the hawk, then another, and another. The flight was ungainly now.
"No!"
screamed Lug, raising a slender hand to point at the struggling bird. Ruad watched in amazement as 2 fragile bronze feathers, which had dropped from the bird, reversed their flight and pinned themselves to the wings once more. For a few seconds, the hawk steadied. Then the wings snapped shut and it plummeted to the ground, lifeless and ruined. Lug ran to it, gathering the feathers and cradling the twisted body. Ruad Rofessa came up silently, laying his hand on the boy's shoulder.
"Do not let this dismay you, Lug. My first bird did not even make the window. It was a great achievement."
"But I wanted it to live,"
he protested.
"I know, and it did. It found the sky. Next time, we will check the neck joints more thoroughly."
"Next time?"
repeated Lug sadly.
"I reach the age next week. There is no place for me in the house, and I shall be sold."
"That is next week. Many things can happen," said Ruad. "Bring the bird back to the forge, and we will see what can be saved."
"I think I will run away. I will join Kalaw. Give us..."
"Stronghand may not be an easy man to follow, but we will talk about this on another day. Trust me, Lug. And now let us see to the bird."
Ruad watched as the youth wandered the hillside gathering the fragments of metal. The feathers had fallen away, and they reversed their flight, albeit for only a few seconds. Yet Lug had only reached the yellow, the least of the colors. Back at the workshop, They left the bronze fragments and sat by the fireside. Lug was silent and sorrowful.
"Tell me," said Ruad softly, "what did you feel when you shouted to the sky?"
The youth looked up.
"Despair,"
he answered simply.
"No, I mean at the moment when you screamed."
Lug shrugged.
"I do not know what you mean, sir. I wanted it to fly."
"Did you notice what happened when you called out to it?"
"No, it fell."
"Not immediately," said Ruad. "It tried to gather itself in some way. You were still linked with it. But you say you felt nothing. What color did you feel? Was it the blue?"
Lug sat for a moment, trying to remember.
"No, it was the yellow. I can only reach the other colors through you, sir."
"No matter, Lug. I will think on it. It is almost time for you to be going. Your free time ends at dusk, does it not?"
"I have a little while," said the youth. "Martian says the family will not return from Firbolg until tomorrow. They're bringing guests for the auction."
"It may not be as bad as you think," offered Ruad. "There are many good houses. The Lady Dianu may need a house servant, or the Lord Erin. Both have good names for their treatment of slaves."
"Why should I be a slave?"
Lug snapped.
"Why? The Empire has gone. All the lands are now being ruled by people who were once slaves. Why should I remain? It isn't fair."
"Life has a habit of not being fair, boy. The Fomorian War was the last, and you were a victim of it. But you will have an opportunity to buy your freedom. It is not so bad a life."
"Have you ever been a slave, sir?"
"Only to my craft," admitted Ruad. "But that does not count, does it? You were taken, what, 5 years ago? How old were you? 10? 11? It is the way of things, Lug. Wars cost money, and that is recouped by plunder and slavery. The Gabala fought that war for national pride, for the right to give away their empire and not have it taken from them. You were one of the last victims. I know it is not fair, but a man who goes through life complaining about fairness will make nothing of himself. Trust me on this, boy. There are three kinds of men: winners, losers, and fighters. The winners are blessed by the colors, no matter what they do. Life treats them like gods. The losers waste their energies whining like scolded children. They will amount to nothing. The fighters keep their swords sharp and their shields high. They expect nothing they do not battle for, but they fight until they drop."
"I do not want to be a warrior," said Lug.
"Listen to me, boy," snapped Ruad, "and with your whole mind. I'm not speaking of swordsmen, I'm speaking of life. Your wits are both sword and shield. It is a matter of perspective. If you want something, then plan for it. Think of all that could go wrong, and picture all that could be done to make it right. Then do it. Don't talk about it endlessly. Do it. Set your mind to the task. You have a good mind and a great talent. I do not know how you held that bird in the air, but there is in you a power. So search for it. Build upon it, and never allow despair to rule your heart. You understand me?"
"I will try, sir."
"That is a good enough answer. Now go home, and I will examine the bird."
Lug stood and smiled.
"You've been very good to me, sir. Why do you take the time?"
"Why should I not?"
"I don't know. In Macther, they say you are a hermit who dislikes the company of people. They say you are rude and surly, ill-tempered and short of patience. But I have never found you to be so."
Ruad rose and laid a huge hand on the boy's shoulder.
"I am what they say, Lug. Make no mistake on that. I do not like people. I never have. Greedy, grasping, selfish, and self-serving. But I have a way with talent, boy. I can make it flourish. As a gardener with blooms. You remember the day I caught you hiding in the bushes behind the workshop?
Yes,
said Lug, grinning.
I thought you were going to kill me.
On each Tiern's day for 7 weeks, you had hidden in that spot and watched me work. You showed patience, and that is rare in the young. That is why I decided to teach you a little of the colours. And you have been a good student. If the source is willing, you will continue so to be. Now be off with you.
After the boy had gone, Ruad gathered together the remains of the metal bird, examining the points below the neck which had given way. The pinions were too slender, but only by a fraction. Lug had good hands and a sure eye, but as yet his soul was not attuned to the magic of the sky. But then Ruad knew magic was built on harmony, and a slave boy reaching his majority was unlikely to find it. He could be sold to a ship's captain and spend his life below decks, or to a prince and suffer castration to serve in a harem. And there were other, even less savory ends for a youth of his looks. Yet these perils were not great. The vast majority of the bright young slaves were bought by good masters, who used them well in their businesses, giving them opportunities to buy their freedom at the age of 30. Still, who could blame a boy for fearing the worst? Ruad locked his front door and saddled the old bay mare. He rarely rode into Maktha, but now he needed supplies, salt and sugar, dried meat and herbs, and most of all, more ingots of bronze and gold. Bronze was a good metal for an apprentice to work with, but it did not take to magic like gold. Had Lug's bird been Fomorian gold, it would have flown over the highest mountain and returned at a thought. But gold was scarcer than a woman's virtue. Ruad heaved his ungainly body into the saddle and steered the old mare down the trail between the pines. The ride took 2 hours, and the sight of the white stone buildings of Maktha brought him little pleasure. He waved to the guard on the north gate and rode on to the livery stable owned by Hyam. The old man himself was sitting at the paddock fence, bartering furiously with a nomad trader. Ruad unsaddled the mare and led her to the hay box. Then he brushed her back and returned to the fence, where the debate was hotting up.
"Wait, wait," said Hyam, waving his slender fingers in the nomad's face. "We'll put it to this traveller."
He turned to Ruad and winked.
"Good sir, be so kind as to examine the 2 horses by the rail and give me your honest opinion as to their worth. Whatever you say, I will abide by."
Ruad glanced down at Hyam's fingers, which swiftly flickered an archaic road sign. The burly craftsman wandered to the first beast, a 17-hands-high chestnut stallion of some 8 years. He ran his hands over the strong legs and down the flanks, then moved on to the gelding. This animal was of 16 hands, perhaps 5 years older than the stallion, and showed some evidence of a sway back. Hyam had signalled 40 silver halves for the pair.
"I'd say 38 silver halves, stated Ruad. "You ruin me," squealed Hyam, dancing on the spot. "How can this happen to an honest man?" "You agreed to abide by this man's decision," the nomad reminded him. "And though it is 5 pieces more than I offered, I will accept." "There is a conspiracy in heaven against me," said Hyam, shaking his head, "but I have been trapped by my own stupidity. I thought this man knew horses. Take them. You have a bargain beyond your dreams."
The man grinned and counted out the money. Then he led the horses from the paddock. Hyam transferred the silver to a hip pouch and sat back, grinning.
"You are a rascal," said Ruad. "The stallion has an inflamed tendon. It could be lame within the week. And the gelding? Its spirit is gone.
Hardly surprising, said the old man softly. They are from the Duke's tables, and he's not kind to them. How is life for you, Hyam?
It could always be better,
answered Hyam, running his hand through his thinning white hair.
But there are bad times coming.
According to you, and all our traders, times are always bad, said Ruad, smiling.
Oh, I cannot deny it, Ruad, my friend, but this is different, believe me. You can see the signs throughout Macfa. The number of beggars has increased since your last visit. And whores? The town swims in new whores. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have complained about that, but now I see it for what it is. Many are good women who have lost their husbands or their homes. Walk down the streets of trade and see the closed shops with their barred windows. And the price of slaves is dropping. That is never a good sign. The beggars fight among themselves for the best sights. And the number of robberies has doubled since last year.
Does the Duke take no action?
Hyam hawked and spat.
What does he care about Macfa? I hear news from all over the Duke's realm. He's almost doubled the taxes everywhere. Farmers must give him 20% of their crops, or else yearlings. And since most of the farmers rent their lands from the nobility, they're left with about 10% to feed their families and plan for the coming year.
Several men had gathered to view the horses. Hyam signalled Ruad to silence, and they continued their conversation using road sign.
There is madness in the air, my friend. The Duke ordered 3 men impaled last month. They crime? They wrote to the king asking for justice against the raised taxes. The king sent Earl Tollibar, the Duke's cousin. Now justice is to be served against the 3 men who asked for it. There's a sort of dark poetry there.
Impaling was outlawed more than 20 years ago, said Ruad.
But in those days the knights rode the land and the old king ruled. Do not look to yesterday, Ruad. Yesterday's dead, gone, like the knights.
All the councillors cannot be dead, protested Ruad.
What of Caleb? Poisoned, so they say.
Rulik?
Killed in a hunting accident. I should get in supplies for the winter, Ruad. There is a bad feeling in the air.
Look after the mare,
said Ruad aloud. He walked out through the crowd gathering for the horse auction and onto the streets of trade. As Hyam had said, many traders had closed their businesses. It was not a good sign. A young woman approached him.
Your pleasure, sir?
He smiled at her.
Business must be bad for you to approach one so ugly.
She did not return his smile.
Only 3 copper quarters,
she said, her eyes avoiding his. He took her hands and turned them over. They were clean, the nails scrubbed.
Why not?
He told her, and followed her through a maze of alleys to a dismal structure with a broken door. Inside it was clean but dingy. And a baby slept on a pile of blankets by the far wall. She led him to a pallet bed and swiftly lay back, hauling her woolen dress up around her hips. Ruad was about to loosen his belt when he heard a movement behind him and stepped sideways, so that the club whistled harmlessly past his shoulder. Turning, he hammered a blow to the assailant's midriff, doubling him over, then cracked the blade of his right hand to the man's neck. He was unconscious before he hit the ground. The woman sat up, her hand over her mouth.
We needed money, she said. He's not dead, is he?
No, said Ruad, and you'll get your money when you've earned it.
He loosened his belt. Ruad stepped from the gloom of the dwelling into the sunlit street, his good eye narrowing, his senses alert. The woman had been a disappointment, bursting into tears as he moved to her. She had made him angry, and unlike some men, anger had no part in Ruad's sexual desires. He addressed and left her. He found his way back to the main street, brushing aside beggars as he walked. Hyam was right. Macther was becoming a running sore. The street of Orr was near deserted, and Ruad was surprised to see boards being hammered across the windows of Cartain's establishment. The front door was open, and he stepped inside. The former nomad was supervising the packing of several large crates, but he spotted Ruad and waved him through to the back room. Cartain joined him there, and poured a goblet of apple juice, which he passed to the bemused craftsman.
"You are leaving too?" said Ruad. "Why?"
The tall, angular merchant sat down at his desk, his dark, slanted eyes fixing on Ruad.
"You know why I am rich?"
he asked, stroking his hawk beak of a nose.
"I've always disliked my questions being answered by questions,"
Ruad snapped. Cartain grinned, showing a golden tooth.
"I like you, Ruad, but answer my question. You buy cheap and sell dear. Now why are you leaving?" "I am rich," said the merchant, smiling at Ruad's increasing annoyance, "because I read the wind. When it blows fresh, there is money to be made. When it blows bad, there is money to be made. But when it does not blow, it is time to move on." "You are an irritating man," Ruad told him, "but I shall miss you. Where now shall I peddle my toys?" "I will send someone to you. Your work is still highly sought after. Do you have something for me?" "Perhaps, but I need gold ingots and more bronze. Also a quantity of that eastern oil." "How much gold?" Cartain asked, leaning back and averting his eyes. "You will earn 300 rack for my little singer. I will take the equivalent of 100. "Show me."
Ruad opened the leather pouch at his side and took from it a small golden bird with emerald eyes. He stroked its back and stood it on his palm. Then, lifting it to his lips, he whispered a word. The bird's metallic wings spread and it rose from his hand to circle the room. Soft music sang from its beak, and a heady perfume filled the air.
"Beautiful," said Cartain. "Simply exquisite. How long will the magic last?"
3 years. 4.
Ruad lifted his hand and the bird spread its wings and glided to his palm. He passed it to Cartain.
"And the words of command?"
"The name of its maker."
"Perfect. You are a master.
There is a king far to the east who desires a giant eagle to carry him into the sky. He would pay in diamonds as large as skulls."
"It is not possible," said Ruad.
"That cannot be true, my dear partner. All things are possible."
Ruad shook his head.
"You do not understand the limits. Magic is a finite power. A long time ago, Zanizar sought to extend it. He used the blood of innocents. It did not work then, and it will not now."
"But supposing 1,000 people were willing to give their blood?"
"There are not 1,000 people in all the world who can drink the colors. Forget his diamonds, Cartain. How rich can one man be?"
Cartain chuckled. "He can have all the wealth of the world, and 1 copper piece more." Ruad drained his apple juice.
"Now tell me, why are you leaving, and not a single word about the wind, if you please?"
Cartain's smile faded.
"There are bad times coming, and I want no part of them. My messengers tell me of evil deeds in the capital. This in itself would be of no consequence to a nomad like me. But King Ahak's mismanagement has left him with a thin treasury. Several nomad merchants have been arrested, accused of treason and tortured to death. Their wealth has accrued to the king. Old Cartain will not feed the vulture's treasury. I had my problems with the king, said Ruad. He is arrogant and headstrong, but he is no despot. He has changed, my friend, Cartain told him. He has surrounded himself with men of evil, even recruited men for a group he called the Knights of the New Gabala, and they are terrible. It is said he was gravely ill, and a sorcerer cured him, but his soul died. I do not know. These stories abound. But then men will always talk of kings. What I do know is that the climate is not good for nomads, or those of nomad blood. I have seen these things before, in other lands. No good will come of it. Where will you go? Across the inner sea to Citheron. I have relatives there, and a young wife. You have a wife here, as I recall. A rich man cannot have too many wives. Why not come with me? We could make a fortune. I do not desire a fortune, Ruad told him. Have my goods sent to the mountains tomorrow. I will. Take care, craftsman. All secrets have a habit of becoming known, and yours, I fear, will prove no exception. And this time, you would lose more than an eye. Ruad left the merchant and wandered back towards the stables, stopping to eat at a small inn. Cartain's planned departure bothered him, leaving him uneasy. Cunning as the merchant was, he was also a man to be trusted. There were few like him, and Ruad needed him. He finished his meal and sat staring at the gathering clouds. All secrets become known. There was truth in that, but it was a problem for another day. He paid the innkeeper and, carrying a sack of provisions, returned to the stable. Hyam had gone, but his younger son saddled Ruad's mare. The boy was sharp-eyed with a flashing smile.
You should buy a new horse, said the lad. This one is worn out.
Ruad mounted and grinned down at him. This is the beast your father sold me 2 months ago, swearing on the souls of his sons that she would run forever.
Ah, replied the boy, but then father's not as young as he was. Now I have a gelding that was sired by Boethicus, and even a man of your size could ride him all day and see not a mark of sweat upon him.
Show me, said Ruad, following the boy back into the paddock. The black gelding was almost 17 hands high, with a strong back and good legs. Ruad dismounted.
Is it true, he asked the horse, that your sire was Boethicus?
The gelding swung its head.
No, it replied. The boy is as big a liar as his father.
The lad backed away, his eyes wide and fearful. Ruad shook his head.
And you looked so innocent.
You are a sorcerer, the boy whispered.
Indeed I am, and you have offended me, said Ruad, fixing the boy with a bleak look.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir, truly. Please forgive me.
Ruad turned away and remounted his mare.
Your father may be old, boy, but he was never stupid.
He heeled his mount and set off for the mountains. The lad was gullible and deserved to be fooled. Even as a child, Hyam would have known the difference between magic and trickery.
All secrets become known.
He calmed his mind and reached into the colours. It took him time to find the white and ease his fears. At the top of a rise, he swung in the saddle to look back at Maktha. The sun was dropping behind the mountains, and the town was bathed in crimson. Ruad shivered, and, before he could steel himself, a vision shook him. 8 knights in red armor, their faces ghostly white, their eyes filled with blood, were riding across the sky with dark swords in their hands. With a great effort, Ruad tore himself clear of the vision,
rubbing the sweat from his face. He kicked the mare into a run.